Hello and welcome to Happy Place. I'm Fern Cotton and today we've got a great episode for you. Well, they're all great, but this one is super special because it's with author and screenwriter Juno Dawson.
There was something about me that knew I was a girl and I like that and I celebrate it. I couldn't celebrate it for a really long time. You know, I went 28 years without being to celebrate who I was. Kind of did through my fandom of the Spice Girls. That was as close as I got.
We cover some big, big subjects in this chat. Have a look at the show notes for this episode for any triggers. But trust me when I say you'll really get to know and love Juno just as much as I do. She's inspiring for so many reasons and I can't wait for you to meet her.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And now here's the show. So today we're off to meet Juno Dawson, a best-selling author of young adult fiction, who until a few years ago went under the name James Dawson and has slowly made the transition from he to she. I'm so excited to speak to Juno for lots of reasons, not least the fact that gender is such a lively issue at the moment and it can often feel difficult to know what to say. So my hope is that we can learn a bit more about Juno's personal journey of self-discovery and how we can apply that to our own lives and the way we think about who we are.
My earliest memories are about girls. I was very, very aware that there was a fundamental difference between what I was being told I was and what I was seeing, particularly in the media, and I think the media was really important for me. And so, you know, I was born in sort of the low, mid to late 80s. And so it was kind of like cartoons like He-Man and She-Ra and Care Bears.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even necessarily tell you what the difference between masculine and feminine was. It was very magnetic. And the ones that really stand out was like Sheila in Dungeons and Dragons, where I just knew I was going to be Sheila. And when we played on the street, which was like this sort of little cul-de-sac of terraces near Bradford, I was always Sheila and I would put my hood up and turn invisible, obviously. And it was just never a question in my mind. There was never a minute of doubt. You know, as soon as I knew there was a difference between boys and girls, I knew I was a girl.
And it's not even like you were trying to, I guess, figure that out or articulate it. It was a feeling and it was an intuitive feeling that there was a difference and you were drawn to that.
It's strange, isn't it? Because I watched this in my nieces, who I think are 10 and 7 now. I should know that, really. And it's so interesting to see them make the preferences they make and make the choices they make. And I think it comes from like a very, very sort of primal, fundamental place, which is, I remember being in toy shops and being so drawn to My Little Ponies and Girls World styling heads and Barbies. And I couldn't tell you what it was about them. You know, I certainly wasn't thinking of political correctness and, oh my gosh, body image, because I was, what, 3 or 4? But I just knew those were the things I wanted. And initially, because I was an infant, I was allowed them. But as I grew a bit older and it became, people started to take those things away from me. And of course, in the book, I wrote a lot about having my Penelope pit stop, who was just a bedraggled Barbie doll. I had my Penelope pit stop taken away from me and I was devastated.
So when you had those moments where you did have toys removed and you realised that those supposedly sort of feminine things that you were drawn to didn't correlate with what you saw in the mirror or what you were being told, how did that make you feel and how did you sort of deal with that at such a young age?
I do remember being, I think the word now that we would use on the internet is shamed. I was sort of repeatedly shamed in lots of ways, both quite explicitly in that I was told to, you know, stop running like a girl, stop skipping like a girl, stop speaking like a girl, but then in also lots of different ways as well. So kind of, you know, like having the toys taken off, asking for things for Christmas, but then actually being given sort of more gender appropriate toys, kind of. So in lots of different ways, I was being told that I was getting it wrong. I think that sort of manifested more as I entered sort of puberty and adulthood, which is where you, I think you have more of a sensation of feeling bad about yourself. The worst years looking back, and this is really with hindsight, at the time I thought everything that I was going through was quite standard, because you do, because you've only ever lived as yourself.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So I think 13, 14, 15 were the really bad years, and it manifested as really horrific anxiety.
Mm.
And really for those years, I just didn't really leave the house. I was just kind of in my room watching Doctor Who on VHS, which is great. And actually was quite satisfied doing that. But it wasn't living a full life in the way that my friends were. So strangely, you know, I was incredibly sheltered. You know, I didn't really blossom until, you know, I hit sort of 18, 19 and I'd left home and had found a new group of friends as well who kind of celebrated the fact that we were all misfits. And I think I was definitely about 17 or 18 before I learned it can be a wonderful thing to be different, and that actually going against the grain is something you should actually play with rather than deny. And of course, it was around that time, you know, I started wearing eyeliner and going full Manic Street Preachers, Placebo.
Love that.
Thank God for the acceptable alternative.
Love that. But like, as you say, that age, sort of being a young teenager, 12, 13, is extraordinarily hard anyway. Mm-hmm. But what you were dealing with added a whole other layer of stuff that you had to consider and work out. And like you're saying, you kind of just went in and just didn't want to be out and show what you were really about. How did you express what felt like your true self and your feminine side, even in that sort of the boundaries that you'd had to create for yourself? How did you express your femininity and kind of just be you within those boundaries?
I think like a lot of teenagers, I was a writhing mass of anxiety about my body, full stop. I was an incredibly late bloomer. And so the strangest thing is, up until I was about 16, I kind of looked like a girl anyway, because I was so small and so slight. And all through school, people were saying, lol, Dolly Dawson. That was my super kind nickname. I should have considered Dolly as a name, really.
Dolly's a great
name. Worked. So I was Dolly Dawson all through school. And so I kind of thought, honestly, that there was something wrong. And I did start to question at that time, you know, should I have been a girl? You know, am I a girl? You know, because I don't look like boys at all. And then when puberty did kick in, it was quite late. It was about 16. Now, I know a lot of trans people talk about puberty as being incredibly traumatic because your body is just completely going in the wrong direction. But I thought there was something wrong with me. And so actually when puberty kind of started, I was like, oh, phew, kind of at least my body's not broken.
Mm.
And at the time, I had no concept that being trans was a thing. So at the time, I kind of felt sort of like a weird relief that at least this thing I'd seen everybody else go through, oh, it was now happening to me. And in a strange way, I'm kind of almost quite glad that I didn't know transitioning was an option, because I think puberty would have been unbearable, because in the 90s, I wouldn't have been able to access treatment on the NHS. And I would have just had to go through puberty, watch my body go the way it went. And I think that would have been really sad. And I know now when you speak to trans youth, you know, they are terrified of puberty because they know, you know, what's going to happen to them if this kicks in, kind of. And that's why they're all so chomping at the bit to start their treatment, because they can maintain a much more feminine or masculine kind of body.
Yeah, and not have to face that fear of turning into something that you don't feel that you are. That's an incredibly difficult thing to have to go through.
Yeah, I mean, because I've been through it as an adult, and yeah. I always think that's a kind of weird privilege because, you know, I had my house and my career and my friends and my family, and sort of approached in quite a mature, quite grown up, business-like way almost. But really what my last sort of 4 years have been about is about undoing that puberty and kind of sort of trying to sort of fix what once went wrong, like an episode of Quantum Leap, for example.
How has that process felt to you? How has that been? Has it been cathartic, traumatic, therapeutic, a release? How's that felt?
a little bit of all of the above, I think. Mm. It's been weird. Mm. It is weird. I think if you weren't like 100% sure that you were doing something that was always meant to be, I don't know how it would feel, because it's quite exhausting, actually. It's a big physical, quite evasive. Is that the right word? Invasive? Evasive? Invasive,
don't
I think.
Don't ask me. You're the writer here. Yeah.
It's hardcore. it really does. It takes over every element of your life initially, sort of like your social life and your family life. And then as you initiate your medical transition, it becomes... Well, it's basically puberty round two. So you're doing it all again. So the mood swings and strops and bursting into tears, and quite physical growing pains as well as your body changes. And then on top of that, you know, surgeries and all the fun that comes with recovery time and anaesthetics. And so it's grueling. But at the same time, and this is going to sound a bit crystal candle incense, incredibly kind of spiritually rewarding because you're finally just being yourself. And, you know, there are days where I'm just like, oh, like, was this the right thing to do? And you're like, yes. Like, you think about it for about a second. You think of, like, 3-year-old me knew this. Mm. You know, I should have just listened to her. She knew.
Yeah, that intuition was there from the get-go. It was just, you knew you had a long road to get to where you are now, which I imagine also brings a huge sense of confidence from, if you think back to when you were 13 and being confused and not knowing, you know, all these different people having opinions and telling you different things and you having to work out your own route and what that meant to you. And now you're at a place where you're just you and you feel comfortable. That confidence surge must have been huge for you.
Yeah, I think what it's like, and this is something that the tone of the press gets slightly wrong, this makeover, you know, the narrative is kind of like, oh, you know, she started dressing like a girl. No. She stopped dressing like a boy. Mm. It's a process of taking something off rather than putting something on. And of course, anything coded male felt incredibly heavy and uncomfortable to me. So doing everything the way I live now is incredibly freeing. And so of course you feel more confident because you're not being like weighed down by all these things which felt very alien. I likened it, I think I was talking to Lorraine Kelly about it, and I said I likened it to like being forced to dress like a pineapple every day of your life. Like how ridiculous and absurd you would feel, and how wonderful you would feel when you finally got to take the pineapple costume off. Mm. To be like, thank God it's gone.
Mm. Can you sort of look at your own personality and identity and go, well, these bits feel very feminine and these bits feel very masculine to me?
I mean, I think we've been told our whole lives that certain attributes of ourselves are masculine and feminine. And it's really hard to know sort of which came first.
Yeah.
Is it that men are more aggressive or ambitious or ruthless and women are more nurturing and caring? Or is it that these are the traits that have been conditioned and praised and rewarded? So when we see a little girl cradling a baby doll, she's told, oh, look at that. She's so lovely with that baby. You see a boy with a baby doll and you take it off him. Mm. So it's kind of, you know,
isn't that peculiar?
Yeah. So it's, although I would say excellent parents all around the world are giving their little boys dolls, and that's wonderful. And we should be rewarding that as well. And whereas, you know, and the reverse is true of little boys. So they're encouraged for being, oh, you know, boys will be boys and rough and tumble and, you know, encouraged towards sports and physical activity in a way that girls don't. That's not very ladylike.
Mm.
So it's hard to tell. Certainly, and I think this is one of the sort of things where sort of trans women and trans men, obviously, as well, and we have slightly unique perspective in that we are aware of what we were praised and encouraged towards as kids. And I know that I was certainly never shamed or told not to be ambitious. I was always told, you know, that I could pretty much do whatever I wanted to do. No one ever, ever once, until the last 5 years, ever asked me if I was interested in kids. Like, it was never discussed. You know, I was never asked in interviews, ever.
Mm.
And I wonder possibly if, even as a little girl, if my sister was asked, you know, do you think you'll have babies one day? So I never factored in, you know, family. It was all about career and all about sort of success. And I don't think, you know, I was never called a ruthless bitch.
Mm.
Whereas I think, you know, when I was starting out as an author, I think ruthless is the wrong word, but I was certainly really driven and ambitious, and I knew what I wanted and I had goals, and I freed up a lot of time. You know, I went to every book launch and every awards ceremony and every function and, dare I say it, networking event going, whereas if I'd have been 25, 26 and had two kids the way my sister did when she was 26, I don't think I would have been at all those networking events. Mm. And I think I know some female authors who are ambitious and they get called bitches.
I think that one is so frustrating because I'm very ambitious as well, and I don't want to be labelled anything apart from someone that likes their job and works hard. And like you, you know, possibly for different reasons, but my parents and my family and sort of inner circle of friends and people that influence me certainly never said, oh, you can't do that because you're a girl, or you shouldn't be thinking like this. I was always pretty much given free rein to kind of go wherever. And I'm really grateful for that because I am very ambitious naturally. But I still have this sense that that feels like more of a masculine energy. And I can't even articulate why. And also, it's bizarre because naturally we might be inclined to go, well, that's, you know, very sexist, or you're really putting down women by saying that. But that's only, again, because we've been conditioned to think that being ambitious is more important or stronger than being nurturing.
Of course.
Whereas for me, I think, God, it's much harder work nurturing kids than doing the work bit. And I'm sort of trying to juggle the both. But we've also labelled them a negative and a positive, which is such a strange sort of subconscious thing that we've gone, oh, well, to be a woman, it's softer,
it's weaker,
lesser. And it's just not, it's just sort of different. But we've got this subconscious conditioning that we always put it in a box of weaker or stronger. And that's such a strange, because we're going back to, I guess, physical strength rather than it being mental strength, emotional strength, like tenacity, dedication. And that's such a strange thing we've got as well going on.
Oh my gosh, I think misogyny underpins half of the woes of society, which is anything dimly feminine is immediately considered less.
Yeah.
And this is how we've ended up in such a state with the kind of politicians we have. And actually, God, this is quite deep, isn't it? I mean, Margaret Thatcher's a really good example of a woman who almost overcompensated by becoming super masculine. You know, she was very male in her kind of attitude and stance, and concepts of emotional literacy and nurture were very absent. And I think that's kind of where we are. And I think you see this in homophobia as well. I think when gay men and gay women are criticised, it's very often for actually defying gender, not sex. You know, I think gay guys get, you know, you run like a girl, you talk like a girl, why are you acting like a girl? And gay women get, oh, she looks like a bloke, why is she so butch? And I think this misogyny, this kind of assumption that anything female is somehow less than, underpins a lot of issues.
It really does. And I think once you start to sort of unpick it all, you really see that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So, bearing in mind that over the years, there has been progression, and it certainly isn't at the point that we need it to be at, but there's progression with how women are seen in a sense of family, a sense of connecting to other people, and a sense, of course, in the workplace. And there's still lots of change needed, but we are not defined by having to be mothers, housewives, nurturers. We can go out and do pretty much whatever we want. I think there's some terminology that needs to be extinguished slightly, like we can have it all, because I think that leads to complete exhaustion. But I think we've certainly got way more options. Bearing that in mind, that we don't have to become a housewife, we don't have to be mothers, why do you think it is so important for us to still identify with a gender culturally and to go, I am a woman and this is what it means to me?
Oh gosh, that is such a biggie. I think, first of all, that it's a little bit like those people say, oh, I don't see colour, I don't see race. I think actually we have to see gender because we have to acknowledge that half of the world, historically and in modern times, has had a struggle, and that there is still a gap in lots of different ways in terms of access to healthcare, reproductive rights, political rights, economic equality, this whole conversation about Me Too, Time's Up, sexual harassment. So while there are issues that affect women more than men, I think it's really important to recognise that there is a, dare I say it, a class difference between men and women. I think, obviously, like all good intersectional feminists, I believe that women come from all different walks of life and all different backgrounds as well, and that has to be recognised. The struggles of poor women, the struggles of women of colour, the struggles of LGBT women, these are different struggles that has to be added into the equation as well. But moreover, and again, I'm going back to the witchy place again, there was something about me that knew I was a girl. And I like that and I celebrate it. I couldn't celebrate it for a really long time. You know, I went 28 years without being to celebrate who I was. Kind of did through my fandom of the Spice Girls. That was as close as I got. You know, I was as much of a Spice Girl fan as you could be.
I was there with you on that
and
one.
Doing my girl power bit, but not as a girl at the time. And that was really frustrating.
I think you've hit on something really important there, that it celebration. And we perhaps overlook that because we want to try and rectify problems that we see and struggles that we perhaps adhere to in certain points in life. And actually just talking about celebration is really important, and just the positives that are there and honouring that. And, you know, for me, that feels right. And for you, that feels right. And that's a big reason to say, I'm a woman and here I am, for you and for me and any other women out there, transgender women, women of colour, race, background, whatever, to stand up and to celebrate that. I think that's a really great thing. You've just said that.
I mean, I love boys. I do. I love a boy or a man. And, you know, I love my male friends. I love dating men. But, you know, if I don't have a certain amount of time in my week with my girlfriends, I would be very unhappy.
That connection's important
to
them.
Yeah, oh my gosh. And that sort of shared journey. And I think, you know, certainly trans women have infinite things in common with cis women. Last night, we were in a bar watching a load of drag queens, as you do, and somehow we just got talking about where to get the perfect bra. And that was a good hour and a half of my night last night. I think I know now.
Talking about that, how important is it for you to present yourself in a certain way, to dress in a certain way, to wear makeup? You know, this, I think, is something that all of us women think about with how we present ourselves to the world. And I will certainly think about that more so probably at work, with how I want to be seen and for people to see how I'm expressing myself. But then even, you know, I'd be lying if I said I didn't want to wear makeup a little bit on the school run, so I looked less knackered and a bit less old. Yes. And I think, you know, we are lucky that we can be malleable in that sense, that we can change how we look and feel with clothing and makeup. So how important is that to you?
I just think it's about choices. I just think I'm doing what I want now. And I think that's the state that I would want all women all over the world to be in, where you can just do what you want. Mm. And I say that, again, coming from a position of privilege, but... And I will say this, you know, in the early days of my transition, I made some errors in judgment. You know, I was a bit kid in a candy shop. I was like, oh my God, I can wear whatever I want now. And I wore some stuff that really didn't suit me. And I looked, I mean, I think it was the Glamour Awards in 2015 where I looked like Ronald McDonald. Brilliant. I mean, let's be really clear about that. I did not look good.
We've all been there. I mean, not specifically Ronald, but we've all
done a Glamour Awards in error. And it was not good. And now I've figured out, again, sort of 32 years in, how my face looks best. Sometimes that involves makeup, sometimes it doesn't. But broadly, as a rule of thumb, it's just, I just wear and do what makes me happy and makes me feel comfortable. I love dressing up for a big night out. You know, and I think that's the slight danger with Instagram, which is you're much more likely to Instagram your big nights out. So everybody thinks you always look camera ready. And that's, you've got to, I'm aware of that, which is why I kind of try to offset it with Instagram stories of me in bed without any makeup on, because I don't want, my readers tend to be teenage girls. And so I don't want them to think you have to look like you've had an hour in MAC every morning, kind of. But for me, it feels a bit like a hobby. And it is a hobby that I think is maligned because it's for girls. And I think it comes back to what we've just been talking about, which is no one has ever called football frivolous or pointless. And yet if I set...
I might have to my husband when he's watching it and shouting swear words at the telly.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, look at the coverage that football and sports getting, you know, broadsheet newspapers. And then I say, oh, I'm obsessed with this new foundation. Everybody's like, oh, you're such a girl. And it's like, well, there's nothing wrong with that. I understand it's not a hobby that everybody likes. A lot of women despise clothes and makeup and just don't want to donate any of their brain time to it. But I enjoy it.
Well, it's expression, isn't it? Yeah. That certainly feels like that for me as well. You know, I want to express how I'm feeling on that day. And it might be a day where, like you say, you wear no makeup and I wear black. Or I'm feeling really colourful and I really go for it. And it's showing the world this is how I'm feeling today. Yeah. And we've got those options, as you say. So let's get on to something I think slightly trickier. And not for you, but I just think sort of generally to talk about being someone that loves words, well, both of us.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're an award-winning writer.
Yeah.
How do you think we tackle language around gender going forward? There seems to be change in this area constantly. So where do you think we should be looking to head to?
I think as long as you're keeping it polite and kind, it almost doesn't really matter. And I know, having spoken to lots of really cool not trans people about especially the media's tone around trans people, there's a lot of people out there who really want to be supportive but are terrified of saying the wrong thing. And I'm just like, oh, just forget about it. You know, as long as you're speaking up in support of tolerance and inclusion and kindness, I don't think it really matters. I mean, I think we all know the really deeply offensive words to avoid.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, I will use it now for the purposes of illustration. There has been a conversation about the term tranny. And I think that that came up from that kind of RuPaul's Drag Race culture, where I think people sort of got to think, oh, maybe that's an okay word. But actually, for my mind, we know that, you know, trans women in particular, and particularly trans sex workers and particularly trans sex workers of colours, are hugely disproportionately likely to be murdered. And in my mind, that word, the T word, is the word you hear when you're getting your head kicked in.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I wouldn't use it even in a, oh, I'm reclaiming it way. I just wouldn't. And so I think that word is definitely to be avoided. But in terms of the broader conversation, you know, the one that upsets Piers Morgan about kind of like gender non-binary, gender queer, gender fluid, no gender, two gender, you know, it's, it kind of, I don't think it really massively matters. You know, I have friends who identify as gender non-binary for lots of reasons. I mean, maybe they feel they don't identify as male or female. They don't connect to that kind of energy we've talked about in either way. Or for some of them, it's more of a political stance, which is, I feel men and women are treated differently in this society, so I am completely denouncing both of those terms. And I'm like, cool, I get both of those things. I have always felt like a girl, so that's the way I'm going to describe myself. And their decision to describe themselves as non-binary doesn't detract anything from my identity whatsoever. I understand it looks like a lot of things are changing really quickly, but I'm not sure it is. I just think there's a bit of a tabloid obsession at the moment. I think this is nothing new. I mean, I'm researching an article at the moment that looks at the contribution of trans women and trans men to society since the days of suffrage. This has been going on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And, you know, even further back when we look at ancient cultures as well. So it's nothing really new. And I think conversations around trans issues shouldn't distract from any other conversations about women, women's rights. In fact, I think it can be a bit of a diversion, because if we can all just get on board with the idea that trans women are women, then all of a sudden trans rights become women's rights.
Yeah.
And we can just talk about women's rights, fully including trans women in that. And, you know, for me at the moment, my big thing that I think we'll be gearing up towards is this referendum in Ireland about abortion rights. And I have so many friends in Dublin. I've been very lucky. I'm a big bestseller in Ireland, so I spend a lot of time there. And, you know, that's the fight I want to fight at the moment, actually. You know, I think it's outrageous that 11 women a week are getting a Ryanair flight over to have an abortion. That's insane. So sort of conversations around vocabulary around trans people, I think, you know, we're tying ourselves up in knots when we have real work to do in terms of women's rights and equalities.
So how do we, going forward, talk to the younger generations, which that's what you do brilliantly, more than anything, is talk to that that youth and those bright souls that are growing up in a new era? How do we talk to them about gender and men and women, feminine, masculine?
I think they're better at it than us. Mm. I think they already know because they've grown up with broadband in a way that we didn't. Mm. And so they have just this unlimited access to YouTubers and Twitter and Instagram. And now, you know, I felt so alone growing up. Like, I felt like, surely I'm the first person to have ever felt like this. And now I wouldn't have. I would have transitioned when I was about 8 because I would have seen Andrea Pejic or Paris Lees or Monroe Bergdorf. I would have seen these women and be like, oh, right, yes, got it. I understand now. And so strangely, I think we should actually be listening to them, not talking to them. I think they already know. They're better than us. And, you know, I spend half my life in schools. And I'll never forget, I went into City of London School for Girls in Barbican about 3 years ago, right kind of in the early days of my transition. I was like, good morning, girls, which was agendering them to begin with. Good morning. Right, you know, I'm going to tell you about what it is to be transgender. A transgender person is blah, blah, blah. And they were like, yeah, we know we have 2 trans pupils and now we have boys at this school. So it's not just a girls' school. And I was like, this is so embarrassing.
But that wouldn't have happened when we were at school.
Well, of course not. No, yeah. I mean, we're about the same age. We were both educated under Section 28. Mm. So at that time, teachers weren't allowed to talk about sexuality and gender because they would have lost their jobs. So things are very, very different. And I think actually it's our generation older that's still adjusting because younger people today, they have smartphones. Mm. If there's something they don't know, they will Google it.
Absolutely.
You know, and they've always had that power. They're so much further ahead of us. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't protect them, because actually I think what we need to protect them from is the internet. Conversely, I think there's almost as much bad as there is good out there.
Well, yeah.
But in terms of just knowledge and conversations, they're having conversations that we just wouldn't have had. And, you know, all the letters and fan mail I get is from sort of 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. And it's not them I worry about, to be honest. It's the dinosaurs, the Donald Trumps of this world who haven't caught up yet.
How do you feel getting so many letters, emails, people talking to you about things that are very important to spend the time in a very sort of pivotal age in their life? How do you feel being... It's a big responsibility to be that sort of role model and voice of that generation talking about gender.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really tough. And it's something that I've written about this week, because about a week and a half ago, I was on a documentary on ITV called Transformation Street. Mm-hmm. I agreed to take part with that, for better, for worse. Actually, in the end, I think they did quite a good job. It could have been so much worse. And so I've had a week and a half of dozens and dozens and dozens of emails, tweets, messages on Instagram, messages through Facebook. And a lot of them are from really desperately vulnerable young people who are not getting the support they need, either at home or on the NHS. They're on the waiting list to be seen by gender clinics. They're worried they're going to get thrown out of home if they come out as bi, if they come out as gay, if they come out as lesbian. And it's really tough because I'm not a doctor.
No.
And I'm not a qualified therapist. And that's why when I did write Mind Your Head, I would only do it because Dr. Olivia Hewitt agreed to do it with me, and she's a psychologist. So I felt comfortable in talking about mental health when there was a doctor literally sat next to me. And I can't give these people direct advice because I don't know them and I don't know their situation. And, you know, when doctors or therapists or counsellors help people, they have the background, they have the context. And so I feel really sort of powerless to help. But at the same time, what I can do is just be as out there as possible and do things like this. And, you know, as I'm a Stonewall role model, and the whole point of being a Stonewall role model is that you just go out there and succeed. Through me being a transgender woman from a super working class background who has gone on to be a best-selling author, which is quite a posh arena to move in, kind of, you know, it's there you go, I won. You know, I didn't let being trans stop me whatsoever. And I think that's better than me sort of trying to be a counsellor and a therapist as well, because there are amazing counsellors and therapists out there, but I'm not one of them. I'm constantly sort of referring people to This Book Is Gay, because there's a huge long list of organisations in there that can help, organisations like Stonewall, Mermaids, all these amazing people who are just doing such good work for LGBT youth.
And also you're offering up the knowledge that they're not alone. And that in itself is so powerful. Because like you say, when you're growing up, you felt like the only person who'd ever felt like that.
Yeah.
And now people can reach out to you and say, well, I feel like how you've written in your books, and I'm not the only person, and that's making me feel better just knowing that.
Yeah.
It's a huge deal. I think that alienation has probably dissipated a bit over the years because of the internet and because there are more role models who are stepping up and being very open and honest about whatever they're going through in life, and that's a huge deal.
I mean, we know through lots of different research that mental health statistics for LGBT kids are really dire. 45% of trans youth have tried to kill themselves, not just thought about it, they've tried it. And so that's why I think it's so important that myself or Laverne Cox or Andrea Pejic or Laith Ashley, any of these trans people, we just have to be as visible as we can be to let them know there's a future. There's a future worth living for. It's out there. You know, we've arrived at that future. Not entirely unscarred or unbruised, but, you know, we all got here.
Who and, is they? God.
Well, exactly. Oh, my gosh. We've all survived our teens and 20s, kind of.
And that's enough for them to know that, I think, that you're there and that you are doing such positive things, and they can look and aspire to. And also, I think it's about being honest, isn't it? And being open. I think probably all of our generation now are way more honest and open than our parents, certainly our grandparents, about anything going on that feels like a struggle or feels like it's been labelled a negative. And I think the biggest problem for a lot of youth out there, and specifically around gender, is shame.
Yeah.
And shame is such a shitty thing to have to live with, whether it is in regards to your mental health or your gender. But I think by being open, which is what you do so beautifully, allows people to somewhat park their own shame, because they're in it with someone else and they might not know you personally, but you're in it together, and that's a potent thing for them to grab hold of.
And it's like an antidote to the shame. I think that's what, you know, that's why I'm so thrilled that there is these just incredibly positive voices coming through, yours, Gemma Kearney, Catelyn Moran, letting people know that there's different kinds of shame that teenagers receive, sort of fat shaming, slut shaming. These actually, despite anything you might have heard, these are not things to be ashamed of.
No.
And that's why I love this kind of conversation. I love that we have so many voices all adding to this incredibly positive wave of sound, because you just can't get enough of it out there.
I agree. And at the end of the day, whatever subject you're talking about, it might be gender, it might be mental health, it might be class, background, whatever, all it is trying to unify, and it's stopping people building walls and barriers between segregations of society and going, well, you're this, you're over there, and you're separate because you're this over there, and you might not feel so good about yourself because you're over there. It's actually just going, we're all in this together, and let's just all be accepting of each other and get on with it. And that's, you know, that's it at the end of the day, isn't
it? And that you just can't get it wrong. Like, of all the things, you know, for kids to struggle with, I don't really think their gender should be one. I just think you can't, regardless of whether you identify as a boy or a girl or neither, you just can't, how do you get it wrong? And I think that's the problem. I think we pin so much shame on kids for when they get it wrong. And you can't, you just can't. You just can't mess up.
No, because you're just being you.
Just being you. And I think that's a really good message for boys, girls, men, women, that you can't fuck up your gender. Find your way to exist in the most comfortable way you can. And that's going to be different for everyone.
Well, look, it's been such a joy to talk to you.
Yay.
So interesting.
Thank
and
you.
Brilliant.
Got
as
a bit
imagined.
Heavy in places, didn't it?
I love that.
Margaret Thatcher and Trump in one podcast.
Who would have guessed?
I know, right?
Thanks so much to Juno Dawson for inviting me down to Brighton and treating me to a delicious vegan chocolate cake as well. I so enjoyed spending time with Juno. Juno's brand new novel, Meat Market, is out now, and of course it's getting rave reviews. It's already one of the biggest novels of the summer, reaching number one on the Amazon chart. Go check it out, and go Juno. And don't forget that we'll have more super stimulating chat as the Happy Place Festival is coming to London's Chiswick House in August and Tatton Park in Manchester in September. Tickets are selling out fast, so get booking now at happyplacefestival.com. Oh, and next week,
It just gets better and better. I'm thrilled about this one. We're going to be meeting the author of Eat, Pray, Love. It's Elizabeth Gilbert.
There are emails that I respond to immediately. There are emails I respond to within a few days. And there are emails that will sit in my inbox until the fucking sun explodes because I don't know what to do with them. And I can't deal with them. And there are too many. And those emails, there were probably 150 of them in my inbox as usual that day. And I remember just deleting every single one of them. And I've now just do that.
That is next week on Happy Place. Get it as soon as it drops when you subscribe. It's free and you get access to our whole back catalogue. So do it now. A massive thanks again to Juno, to my producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, and to you brilliant souls for listening. Bye-bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.